Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more.
Today we're talking about a topic that I love to talk about, which is cities that formed and influenced jazz in a massive way other than New Orleans and New York. And as we've been learning from previous podcasts, there are a lot of important cities, and somebody lives in another country and wants to tour America. There's a lot of cities you can visit to get a deep, deep, deep dive into the heart of America's music. And one of those great cities is Detroit. And today we're talking with the author of Jazz from Detroit, Mark Stryker. And I've watched a bunch of videos. I've already listened to a number of interviews with Mark, and Detroit is a treasure trove of American music, which we're going to unveil right now. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks. It's really a pleasure to be here and be talking about a subject that I'm really passionate about, and as I think all jazz musicians and jazz fans are passionate about Detroit, because the city has been so critical to the history of the music.
Let's start with the beginning. You know, there's this myth that jazz started in New Orleans and it worked its way up the Mississippi and spread out throughout the nation. And when we look at what actually happened, it appears that jazz kind of sprung up everywhere simultaneously. New Orleans was, of course, a powerhouse for various economic and social reasons, you know, not to diminish New Orleans' role, but it seemed to spring up everywhere in Texas, in Boston even. In San Francisco, apparently the word jazz was originated in San Francisco. Tell us about the early rumblings of jazz in Detroit, and then let's work our way through the history.
Well, jazz and Detroit sort of grow up together at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, the first thing to sort of understand about Detroit is in 1900, Detroit is a pretty provincial city, about 285,000 people. And in 1900, the city of Detroit was manufacturing about 500 cars a year. Fast forward to 1920, and Detroit is now the fourth largest city in the country.
Wow.
With about nearly a million people, and we're manufacturing $1.5 million cars.
Wow.
So that's an extraordinary boom. And this period, we need to remember, too, that Detroit is one of the major beneficiaries of the Great Migration, bringing African Americans to the North, seeking better economic opportunities and less overt racism. And Detroit, because of the rise of the auto industry, there were great jobs here for African Americans. And Detroit is really on the leading edge of creating a black working and middle class in this country. And so all of that is beginning to sort of foment in Detroit in the first few decades of the 20th century. I mean, just skip ahead for a moment. By 1950, when Detroit's population peaks at nearly 2 million, about 300,000 of those residents of the city are African American by then, about 16%. So that's sort of where we're going here. And, you know, in the 1920s, Detroit becomes a center for big bands. And Don Redman comes from New York out to Detroit in the late 20s to lead the band, the unfortunately named but very important band, McKinney's Cotton Pickers. And that band is based here in Detroit, and they're on the radio, and they have, you know, Don Redman is a critical figure in codifying what becomes the large jazz big band. And that's happening here. And at the same time, the most important white big band of the era is based in Detroit, and that's the one led by Gene Goldcat that includes at various times Dick Spiderbeck and Frankie Trumbauer and people like that. And so, you know, those two bands are like happening here in Detroit simultaneously by about 1927, 28. And other than that, we are a were a crossroads here. So all the major bands of the 1920s and 30s begin to are touring through here. That thriving African-American community that I've mentioned, that gives rise to thriving Black nightlife here in an area of town called Paradise Valley. This is the, sort of the center of African-American economic life here in the city with in that era with, you know, scores and scores of bars and restaurants and hotels and work for musicians. And all of this is sort of, you know, percolating during the 1930s. And it is setting the stage for what becomes this extraordinary explosion of homegrown talent here in Detroit at mid-century with basically the coming of modern jazz, of bebop. So, you know, in terms of the Detroit's trajectory of the story of jazz, it is certainly going in the 1920s and 30s, but it's really in the 1940s where we have this major explosion and you begin to have this profound impact of Detroit on the larger national scene.
Yeah, so by the 1940s, it was already second generation of jazz musicians, right? There'd been a continuous existence of jazz on, sounds like a pretty huge level throughout the 20s. So by the 40s, you had kids who grew up immersed in that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, what's really important to understand here is that what happened in Detroit is not an accident. The jazz history here grows out of a very particular and unique set of social, cultural, and economic factors that sort of give rise to this scene at the middle of the century and sustains us here in Detroit over the last 60 years, even as the economic power and population of the city diminished considerably, right, over the last 50 years. Detroit continues to produce great jazz musicians, you know, in effect, punching way above our weight class, more like a Chicago, say, or a Philadelphia. And so it's interesting to, you know, my book looks at, well, what are these factors that created this explosion in mid-century? And then how is it that Detroit managed to sustain its impact over all these decades? And, you know, we should maybe stop here for a minute and let's just think about who the musicians are that came out of Detroit, right? We're talking about here, starting at mid-century, people like Hank Fad and Elvin Jones, Kenny Burrell, Yusef Lateef, Sheila Jordan, Betty Carter, Paul Chambers, Doug Watkins, Donald Byrd, Barry Harris, Curtis Fuller, Charles McPherson, Lewis Hayes, Roy Brooks, you know, Ron Carter, Joe Henderson, Roland Hanna, Tommy Flanagan. You know, it's an extraordinary legacy, and that continues right all the way up into the present day. You think about Kenny Garrett and Jerry Allen, the late Jerry Allen, and
yep.
Robert Hurst, and Rodney Whitaker, and James Carter, and Regina Carter, and Gerald Cleaver, and Kareem Riggins. All these musicians were nurtured here in Detroit. And so, and that's just, of course, the tip of the iceberg. I have, in my book, I have an appendix that lists, you know, some notable jazz musicians from Detroit. And I think I list 175 musicians or so. And I had to quit. I mean, I didn't have room, but I could have gone on for, I could have had, you know, double, triple that. So that's the legacy. And it's, when you think about the influence of the Detroit diaspora, it's been extraordinary. And, you know, Detroit musicians made major contributions to every post-war jazz style there is. Bebop, hard bop, post-bop, fusion, today's contemporary mainstream today, progressive streams today, the avant-garde, hip-hop, hybrids. I mean, Detroit has had a finger in all of those pies across the last 60 years. You know, that really gets going in mid-century. Let's, you know, talk for a minute just about in the early days of bebop. Lucky Thompson, the saxophone player, Teddy Edwards, the saxophone player, Gerald Wilson, the trumpet player and great composer, arranger, Howard McGee, the trumpet player, all of these players, people make, you know, Al McKibben, the bass player, all these people make really important contributions to their first generation bebop musicians. And they're from Detroit. So, you know, that's, we're just thinking about sort of the broader picture that I think it's important to sort of just, let's get a handle on that.
And also, it so happens that Miles and Coltrane used a lot of Detroit musicians in their rhythm section.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the history of the bass in American vernacular music is all Detroit from the middle of the 20th century. I mean, you think about Paul Chambers and Ron Carter and James Jamerson, right there,
yeah.
You've got, that covers a huge swath of American music. And But yeah, I mean, you look at any of the major bands in the 1950s and 1960s, and you're going to find Detroiters. You can't pick up a record that was made on the East Coast between, say, 1956 and 1970 and not run into 1, 2, 3, 4 or more sometimes Detroiters. And so
it's kind of a secret hidden in plain sight that huge portion of modern jazz was driven by Detroit-born and trained musicians.
Yeah, the theme of my book is that you cannot tell the history of jazz in America without also telling the history of jazz from Detroit, that those two things are indivisible. And, you know, I came to Detroit in 1995. I grew up as a jazz musician, as a saxophone player. You know, I've been deeply immersed in this music since I was 10 or 11 years old. And so I knew when I came here that Detroit had all these musicians that came from here. Because I, you know, you read back of liner notes, the liner notes on the back of LPs and all that. You begin to get a sense of saying, oh, this guy's from Detroit and that guy's from Detroit. And, you know, you saw people referring to sort of a Detroit school sometimes. And yet it wasn't until I got here that I begin to understand how that happened and how profound the influence was, and that when you put it all together, it's really a unique and compelling story. So anyway, maybe we should talk a little bit about these factors that sort of led to this explosion.
Absolutely. And I wonder if we could cover that in a second. There's one story that I think is so extraordinary, especially in terms of jazz, and that's the Jones family. I mean, it's almost hard to believe that three such spectacularly important and influential musicians could have come from the same family. And I think there's some jazz fans that don't realize they were brothers. They just think, hey, you know, it's a common name. What was going on with the Jones family? How did this family come to be?
Well, the family in some ways offers a kind of microcosm for all of the Detroit jazz experience. I mean, first of all, the family is from Mississippi, and Hank, who was born, the pianist who was born in 1918, is actually born in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and then the family moves as part of the Great Migration to Pontiac, just north of Detroit, and the father works at General Motors, as I recall.
Okay.
So it's a typical Great Migration story that brings the family to Detroit. You know, the father sang with a great sort of booming bass, and the mother was musical. You know, Hank likes to say that he had a sister who he says was the most talented musician of the whole bunch, who died young.
Oh.
She was a pianist.
Okay.
It was a large family. There were 10 children, including, you know, Elvin was a twin, actually, was born a twin, and his twin sibling died young, very young, as an infant. And so it was a big family, a lot of love in the family. And, you know, how do you explain necessarily, you know, so much musical talent in one family? There's not one thing you can point to other than the fact that, you know, Hank was playing very well young. And Hank was born in 1918, sad. The middle brother, the trumpet player, was born in 1923, composer, arranger, and Elvin in 1927. And so both Elvin and Thad looked up to their brother Hank, and so he helped train them to the extent that, you know, Elvin talks about playing along with Hank on a phone book with brushes while Hank played piano, that kind of thing. But one thing I think that's interesting about the brothers is that, you know, there's 9 years basically between Hank, born in 1918, and Elvin, born in 1927, mm-hmm. And then Thad right in the middle. And yet Hank comes of age really in the swing era. And, you know, he's really a fully formed musician by the time he gets to New York in about 1944. And he then adapts the new bebop styles as it's coming in. But as Hank would tell me, you know, he never felt like he was really a fully fledged bebop player. He was always just sort of reaching for it, he felt like. And then Thad is a little bit younger, and Thad really comes of age in the height of the bebop era, and then becomes, you know, Thad is actually in the service with the military band, and in 1945, 46, I believe it's 45, where he first hears Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie on the radio, and is just you know, captivated by this music. And so Thad really comes of age with bebop and then becomes this important voice in the early beginnings of hard bop. And then Elvin now is a little younger, and Elvin doesn't really get his playing together until the early 1950s here in Detroit. And then he becomes this key figure in New York and a leader of the post-bop and moving toward the avant-garde through the 1960s. So if you think about it, just with those three brothers, you have cover the whole spectrum of the history of the music, basically, as I like to say, from ragtime to no time. Mm-hmm. One of the Jones brothers will sort of have you covered. Mm-hmm. And when you think about elements that make up the Detroit character in jazz, ideas like Detroit musicians can all really swing. They can all really play the blues. Mm-hmm. There's a really smart, intelligent kind of approach to the creation of musical line and construction. Detroit musicians are all very well trained. They're deeply rooted in the tradition, and yet there's also the notion of finding your own individual voice in the music. And, you know, the three brothers all exemplify that. Elvin was certainly an innovator, without a doubt, one of the handful of the most important drummers in jazz history. Thad was one of the great big band arrangers, composers that this music has ever known, and yep. A unique, completely unique trumpet player. And Hank was a major stylist and individualist as a pianist. And there was absolutely nothing that Hank could not do in the music. Yeah. And so those three, you know, they form a central, you know, triumvirate basically in the center of my book. They get their own chapter because they're so important to the history of Detroit and to the history of jazz writ large.
So it's a pattern that repeated itself many times. A lot of the families probably the vast majority were not Detroit natives, so to speak. They people that came up from the South, from Mississippi, from Alabama, from Louisiana. So they were first generation in Detroit, exposed to all kinds of economic opportunities that would have been denied them back in Mississippi. So access to instruments, for one thing, a piano, and then having time to get a proper education, which probably would have been denied them in Mississippi. So a lot of resources suddenly available to very creative, very hardworking, very intelligent people, and they were able to flower.
Well, yeah, and let's remember we're talking about the parents. It's really the parents' generation of the Jones brothers, you know, of a Tommy Flanagan, of a Gerald Wilson, that we're talking about here, moving to find, you know, opportunities for their kids, let's say, and for the families. But, you know, I think about Gerald Wilson as an interesting example in this regard, because, you know, Gerald is also from the South. The family is from the South. Mm-hmm. and stayed in the South. But he was sent to high school first to, when you talk about, you know, the opportunities in a Detroit, you think about somebody like Gerald Wilson, who was born in Shelby, Mississippi, and was very interested in music early on. And there was no school for blacks beyond the eighth grade in uh-huh. Shelby. And so Gerald's mother sent him to live with family in Memphis to start high school. And that's where he started to take trumpet lessons. And then in 1934, he takes a trip to the World's Fair in Chicago. And he is so exhilarated by that, he begs his mother to let him go up north. And so she sends him to Detroit to live with friends. And he ends up going to Cass Tech High School, which is, we'll talk about this in a moment, but Cass Tech is one of the major drivers of Detroit musical greatness as highly refined music training factory, basically. Mm-hmm. And Gerald walks in the first day, and that Cass Tech is integrated, and he just felt sort of this rush of freedom mm-hmm. and opportunity. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are opportunities in Detroit that were unique. Again, that goes back to the rise of the auto industry, helping to create a black working and middle class, which creates a thriving, economic, vibrant African-American community that creates nightlife. This music does not thrive without thriving economic class of African-Americans, right? Mm-hmm. Jazz is an expression of black culture. And so that's sort of the first pillar of the Detroit story is the Great Migration and the rise of the auto industry. Then you have Detroit had some of the best public school music education in the country, which is critical. And then you combine with that Detroiters, we had really important mentors in the community, particularly at mid-century in the 1950s, Barry Harris, the pianist, is sort of professor of bebop that trains all of the musicians that come up behind him. So this combination of formal education in the schools, so kids really learned how to play their instruments in the sort of Western classical music tradition. Everybody had technique, everybody understood theory and all of that. Everybody could read, and you combine those skills with a great mentor in the community, like Barry Harris, teaching jazz as the oral tradition. And you combine those things in the context of a thriving African-American nightlife driven by the auto industry. That's a powerful set of combinations that you do not get in other cities. And it's the first set of circumstances that really impacts this mid-century explosion of jazz in New York. Now, there's some other jazz in Detroit, rather. There's some other factors, too. We can talk about those in a moment. But the schools, the public schools, the mentorship, those are critical. It's a critical combustible combination.
Let's talk about one of the schools, and there's probably more than one, but clearly Cass Technical. I'm just going to do a quick list. Jerry Allen, Kenny Burrell, Donald Byrd, Regina Carter, Ron Carter, Paul Chambers, Alice Coltrane. I haven't even gotten to the D's yet. Wardell Gray, Major Holly, Al Jackson, Billy Mitchell. I mean, it goes on. Lucky Thompson. And so this is, it's not only one generation of great musicians that came out of this school, it's multiple generations. So was it one teacher, for instance, in Chicago, you have the famous Captain Diet, you know, who trained apparently everybody from Sun Ra to, you know, Mujal Richard Abrams. Was it that kind of a thing at this school at Cass?
No, the experience at Cass is different. And let me make one quick correction, because this is often misstated. Kenny Burrell did not go to Cass. He went to Miller High School.
Oh, okay.
It's often written that he went to Cass, but he did not. But I tell you, other people that did that you didn't mention would include people like Donald Byrd, Roland Hanna, Paul Chambers, and Doug Watkins, and Julius Watkins all came out of Cass.
I'm also seeing Howard McGhee and Al McKibben.
Yeah, both of them as well.
That's incredible.
Both of them as well. So,
and Gerald Wilson, as you mentioned earlier.
And Gerald, right. So look, the Cass Tech story is that Cass Tech was founded, I think, in the 1920s as a high-achieving school in the technical arts and across disciplines. And so at Cass, you would major in art or music or engineering or design, or you had there were a whole bunch of things that one would major in. And if you majored in music, you spent half your day taking music classes and half taking academic classes. And you took, you know, everybody had to take piano. Everybody had to, you know, basic keyboard instruction. If you were a string player, you also had to learn a wind instrument. Oh. So that's why Ron Carter, who played cello and then bass in the orchestra at Cass Tech, also played alto clarinet in the top concert band. It was high-level, college-level music education at Cass. And there was not one famous teacher in the sense, like as in Chicago, as you were mentioned with Captain Walter Diet. There were a bunch of teachers and individual instructors on individual instruments and some very important band directors and orchestra leaders. Great man named Harry Beejan, who is a legendary name in American music education, as a band director who was at Cass Tech all through mid-century. And later he went to Wayne State and then was at the University of Illinois. And Harry was one of these sort of strict disciplinarians, but he treated all his black and white students equally. Not all the teachers at Cass did that. And he wasn't a jazz guy, but he encouraged people like Donald Byrd and Doug Watkins and people like that. And he opened the band room to them for jam sessions. And Donald Byrd would say, you know, that Harry was like this tough son of a bitch, but he wouldn't let you get away with anything, but I loved him. And I tell you, I heard that kind of story from so many Detroit musicians about these sort of tough love music teachers that they had that really set them on the right path. And so, you know, and Donald Byrd is playing principal trumpet in the orchestra and the concert band. And so very high level training. The schools in Detroit, first of all, the schools in Detroit were integrated by law. So even though there were, you know, social forces and redlining and housing discrimination and things that were pushing toward greater segregation, the fact that schools in Detroit were integrated is really important. It meant that Black kids got the same opportunities that white kids did at some of the best schools like Cass Tech. The bands at Cass Tech were so good that when band leaders like Jimmy Lunsford and Basie and Ellington and Lucky Millinder and people like that would come to Detroit to play Paradise Valley, they would go over to Cass Tech during the day to hear the bands, to scout talent and just see who the kids were that were sort of coming up. And that's how Jimmy Lunsford first met Gerald Wilson. And then Gerald would go over and hang out with the Lunsford band on their gigs in Paradise Valley. And then a couple of years later in 1939, when Lunsford needs a trumpet player, he remembers this kid that he had met at Cass Tech named Gerald Wilson, and he sends Gerald a telegram, and that starts Gerald's career. So Cass Tech is a jewel here, but it's also important to remember that it's not the only school, because, you know, unlike in, say, Chicago, where a school like DeSable High School on the South Side is segregated, it's all African-American, it becomes the school. And in Chicago and in Indianapolis, Christus Attucks High School is the African-American high school. That's where J.J. Johnson and David Baker and Slide Hampton and Freddie Hubbard and all the Indianapolis guys come out of Christus Attucks. But in Detroit, the schools were integrated. So you had African-Americans in schools all across the city. And so there were important jazz musicians that came out of all the schools at Northeastern. That's where Barry Harris came from, where he was a classmate, by the way, with a young Barry Gordy. And Northwestern, which is where Charles McPherson and went to school, and Tommy Flanagan was actually, Tommy, I think, was at Northeastern now that I think about it. But and then there was Miller High School, which was served a predominantly African-American neighborhood called Black Bottom. But still, there were some white kids at Miller. The great bebop drummer Art Mardigan and Frank Rosalino, the trombone player, came out of Miller High School. But that's where Kenny Burrell went. That's where Milt Jackson went. That's where Yusef Lateef went. So there were great schools all across the city. And so at Miller, say, Kenny Burrell, who was playing guitar and already at Miller in the stage band there, but you know, Louis Cabrera, who was Mexican-American band director at Miller, took a shine to Kenny and saw his talent and encouraged him to write arrangements and stayed after school to teach him the theory and how to do it. And Kenny told me that when he got to Wayne State University, he didn't have to do homework for 2 years because he learned so much at Miller. And I think my favorite story about Miller is that they had a set of vibes at Miller. Now, the vibraphone was just invented basically in the early 1920s. It's a very young instrument for any school in high school in the 1930s to have a set of vibes, much less an African-American school, largely predominantly African-American school in a place like Detroit, to have a set of vibes is highly unusual. And yet, because we have vibes, that meant that Mr. Cabrera could turn to this talented kid who's already playing percussion in the concert band and is singing in the choir and plays guitar and plays piano. And he could turn to this kid and say, "Hey, Milt, maybe you would like to try the vibes." And of course, this is Milt Jackson, who becomes the most important vibraphonist in American musical history, all because Miller has a set of vibes. So this is the environment here in Detroit, in the schools. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that Detroit becomes a very important contributor to the first generation of bebop, like, you know, with Lucky Thompson and Howard McGee and Wardell Gray and Art Mardigan and these people. And, you know, the reason I'm convinced of this is because Detroit musicians were so well trained, they could be early adapters to the new bebop music, which is a virtuoso music, right? I mean, you have you really got to be able to play your instrument, get around your instrument. There were virtuosos certainly in jazz before bebop, people like Art Tatum and the like, and Louis Armstrong to a large extent. But you didn't have to be a virtuoso. It wasn't demanded of you in the way that it was started to be with bebop. And you needed to know harmony, and you needed to have a sense of sophisticated musical construction and all of these things that you need to be comfortable with more complicated rhythms and all of these things that were sort of part of the bebop era. Our musicians in Detroit were so well trained that they immediately gravitated to this music and understood it and could play it. So I'm convinced that's why Detroit was such an early adapter of bebop.
So Detroit is an example of what can happen when a community decides to put resources into music education.
Oh, no question. One of the quiet themes of my book is that if you invest in music education, you can change the world. And we know that because that's what we did in Detroit. And the schools in Detroit continued to have great music programs through the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way up until the early 2000s, when it was only at that point when the Detroit Public Schools got put under state emergency management by the governor, and essentially local control was taken away from the Detroit Public Schools, and all of us had to deal with financial issues. But it's not really until the emergency managers come into power running the Detroit schools that music and art is completely cut from the schools. And so even though certainly through the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, as Detroit declined, schools declined too, but still, because of the history here, and we remained a center of musical excellence, and key teachers at Cass Tech and at Northwestern, in particular, that sort of kept this jazz flame alive. So, you know, I mean, not to get ahead of our story, but Certainly the fact that the Detroit school, public school music education was decimated in the early part of the 20th century is a very concerning kind of issue for, of course, for all kinds of reasons. But for the musical legacy of the city, it's worrisome. And the good news on this front is that there is a new superintendent at schools. Local control has come back to Detroit, to the schools. There is a new superintendent who came into power 3 years ago, I believe, and he has made restoring music and art a top priority. And so he gets it. And hopefully it's going to take a while, of course, to sort of rebuild, but hopefully that will happen. In the meantime, a number of nonprofits have stepped in that fund major jazz education programs. In fact, it's interesting. We have a network essentially of nonprofits that do jazz education here, and we have a foundation in particular that has jazz is a focus of this foundation. Not the only focus, but a primary focus is jazz education. They're putting hundreds of thousands of dollars a year into jazz education here. And so, you know, because jazz is a part of our cultural DNA, and they recognize that. So that is helping to sort of mitigate the impact of the decline of the Detroit Public Schools. But of course, there is no substitute for putting an instrument in a kid's hand in the third grade, which is what was happening at mid-century. You know, Detroit Public Schools, you know, there was music and art starting in the third grade for students. And you know, that kind of training makes a huge difference.
Sure. I mean, it's normal. They have the runway, a long enough runway that you actually need to develop into a professional musician. It takes a lot of time. And so the sooner you get started, the better. Well, I'm glad to hear that the nonprofits have stepped in, and I'm glad to hear there's a new superintendent. And the same thing happened in New York City. New York City used to have an amazing music program, and that's gone. I mean, they just took the whole thing away. Well, that would be a great thing to begin to restore this. So at somebody or some group in the early years of 20th century Detroit made the decision that music was worth it to have as an integral part of the curriculum. And
yeah, you know, in fact, this is the part of the story that I actually don't know, and I'm interested to find out more about the early days of music education in Detroit to figure out exactly why and how music became a priority. And, you know, to the extent of my research, it was about that by the 1920s, Detroit was already recognized as having high quality music education. And as I said, it's a big pillar.
You mentioned, you know, we have the formal structures, the schools, the curriculum, the teachers, but then there's this informal extracurricular dimension, the mentors, some of whom are employed teachers, of course, who go above and beyond. You mentioned one of them, Barry Harris, but I imagine Detroit must have been chock full of real mentors to youth in music.
Yes, I mean, you know, somebody like the bass player Major Holly was working for the city at like a civic recreational center, and Major Holly had a big impact on somebody like Roland Hanna. He taught Roland Hanna and other kids about the blues, mm-hmm. you know, at this rec center. And, you know, and there were important, you know, there were important private teachers, obviously. I mean, both Tommy Flanagan and Barry Harris and later Kurt Weitzie all studied with the same piano teacher.
Oh, who was that?
In the community. And
I have a theory that one of the great untold, I don't think it is a theory, I think it's reality, that one of the great untold stories of jazz history is the female piano teachers.
Gladys Wade Dillard was the woman's name who taught Barry and Tommy and others. And yes, I think that there are women, largely women, who within the communities become these real pillars of music education. And, you know, in Detroit, Gladys Wade Dillard was one. There was another woman named Josephine Love. Mm-hmm. And Josephine Love had gone to school, I'm trying to remember, Roland Hanna started his piano lessons at age 11 with this woman, mm-hmm. whose name was Josephine Love, who mm-hmm. was, you know, one of these important musical and cultural figures in Detroit's black community. She had gone to Juilliard. She got a diploma at Juilliard. She had an English degree from Spelman College. She had a master's in music from Radcliffe, as I recall.
Wow.
And she becomes Gerald, Roland's first piano teacher. And then Roland ends up studying with some important classical teachers here, the same teachers that trained the great classical pianist Ruth Laredo. Also, those are the same teachers that were teaching people like Roland Hanna. But in the jazz community, the premier mentor in the community and the critical catalytic figure at mid-century is Barry Harris. Mm-hmm. And Barry is born in 1929, and by 1950, still a very young man, he is already beginning to mentor and teach the musicians that are just a little bit younger than him, that are 16, 17, 18 years old. So, you know, people like Curtis Fuller and Donald Byrd and Doug Watkins and Paul Chambers are all among the first group of, you know, Barry's students, let's say. And, you know, Barry in the early 50s, he's got a very analytical mind. He's putting the music of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Powell under a microscope. He's trying to figure out the grammar of the music. And as he's figuring the music out for himself, he's teaching it to others. And he's mm-hmm. running more or less a kind of, you know, a Socratic salon out of his house on the west side of Detroit. And everybody that, you know, people would just fall by the house, and there would always be one, two, or sometimes just one or two. Sometimes you'd have a whole big band worth of people at Barry's house, and they'd sit around the piano, and Barry would be teaching them chords and, you know, harmonic progressions and, you know, bebop songs and turnarounds and theory and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, jazz is an oral tradition. That's how the music is best transmitted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Barry's ideas, his methods that he's sort of originating in the 1950s, those ideas now, dealing with chords and scales, those ideas have now filtered their way into the mainstream of jazz education. I mean, you can go anywhere in the country, even down to the high school, you know, high school level, certainly colleges, people are learning more or less parts of the Barry Harris method without even really knowing that's where it all came from.
Oh, interesting.
And Barry, you know, because Detroit was such a fertile, thriving scene in the 1950s, Barry doesn't have to leave Detroit to keep working and to be working at a high level and working all the time. So that means that, you know, Barry doesn't leave for New York permanently until 1960. Mm-hmm. And so from 1950 all the way until 1960, Barry is in Detroit, mm-hmm. and he's teaching as well as he's playing. And so there are successive generations that come through. So after the group with Curtis and Fuller and Donald Byrd and Pepper Adams and those kids, you know, then it's Charles McPherson and Roy Brooks and people like that. Lonnie Hillier, and then it's Joe Henderson is after that. And so Barry's impact gets magnified because he's able to stay in Detroit for so long, and that really builds into the culture of Detroit jazz, that this notion of mentorship, which then becomes the key reason why we're able to sustain our jazz legacy, you know, as the city goes through its tough times in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. This culture of mentorship that Barry starts then gets picked up in later decades, most prominently by the trumpet player Marcus Belgrave. So, but I think it goes back to Barry, you know, creating this workshop sort of idea about the music. And, you know, and in the middle 50s and late 50s, it wasn't just that Barry was teaching the Detroit people. He was, you know, when John Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley and Sonny Rollins would come to Detroit, they would all go over to Barry's house and pull up a chair and say, "Hey, maestro, what are you working on?"
Wow.
And so Barry would, you know, talk to them. And you can, you know, Charles McPherson has very distinct memories of John Coltrane and Sonny being at Barry's house. And he can remember, you know, Charles talks about Train coming in and, again, pulling up the chair, "What are you working on, maestro?" And you know, Barry saying to him, "Well, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, playing over 2-5 progressions, and that you can, if you don't have to play the minor chord, the 2 chord, you can just think of it as playing over the 5 chord, the dominant 7th chord. And here's a scale that you can use with this half step in it that allows you to play more fluently over this particular chord pattern." And this, you know, that idea, you know, that this particular scale with the half step over the dominant 7th chord, that becomes a key part of John Coltrane's sort of grammar in his music going forward. So, yeah, it's a profound impact.
And, you know, Mr. Harris is 90 this year, and he is still teaching. He's running regular workshops now in New York City. And, wow, are they reasonably priced. If anybody wants a jazz education, it's almost embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really giving it away. You know, it's interesting, as I look at the list of Detroit jazz musicians, if somebody didn't know better and didn't do a little research, you would think, because they're all associated with New York now. Barry Harris has been there for decades now. You know, Ron Carter, Paul Chambers, Howard McGhee, Al McKibben, these are all people that you kind of associate with New York City. But if you do a little research, you realize this is Detroit speaking. Hey, let's bring it up to the present. We have a lot of international fans who listen to the podcast, and some of them come to the States to travel. And of course, you got to go to the Big Apple, you got to go to the Big Easy. But make the case for why someone that's doing an extended trip in the U.S. and really wants to know American music, that Detroit should be on their agenda, and where would they go when they come to Detroit to hear the scene?
Well, you know, what you hear when you come to Detroit is continuation of this legacy. You know, it's very important for me in my book to emphasize that it's not all history here, that Detroit jazz is an ongoing living tradition. And what you'll hear when you come here, and you hear some of the young players that are coming up here and that are sort of have established themselves now and are making their way in the music, is you hear the contemporary manifestation of this legacy. And so there are some young players, you know, if we want names, Marcus Elliott, a young saxophone player, Michael Malice, a young pianist, Ian Finkelstein, a young pianist, Sean Dobbins, great drummer, Nate Wynn, a great drummer. And these are all, you know, top flight musicians that any scene across the country would be proud to have. And, you know, I think it's interesting that when you think about some of the young musicians here, somebody like Marcus Elliott or Michael Malice, these kids, they're, you know, around 30 years old now. Now, they went to school at places like Michigan State University and the University of Michigan, mm-hmm. where they studied with Jerry Allen at the University of Michigan, mm-hmm. or Rodney Whitaker at Michigan State. And they also, these kids they're just old enough that they were able to come up and play with Marcus Belgrave near the end of Marcus's life. And so in many ways, this generation is sort of Marcus Belgrave's grandchildren. You know, I have because they studied with Jerry and Bob and Rodney and people like that who were Marcus's proteges, and they also worked with Marcus himself. So You know, I have a whole section in my book that's entitled Marcus Belgrave and His Children.
Oh.
And his children, you know, Marcus Belgrave is the trumpet player and the mentor who came up with Ray Charles and then eventually settles in Detroit and, you know, had associations with Mingus and with Max Roach and with Wynton Marsalis. And Marcus ends up becoming the guru of the last 40, 50 years of Detroit jazz and trained Kenny Garrett, Jerry Allen, Bob Hirst, Rodney Whitaker, Regina Carter, Gerald Cleaver, Kareem Riggins, James Carter, dozens of others all came up under Marcus. And now the generation of musicians that are coming up now are people that came up under the people that studied with Marcus. So you see, what you see when you come to Detroit is this chain of generations and the connection here. When you hear jazz in Detroit, it's really a profound, moving experience because jazz here is so embedded in the culture, and jazz is still a social music here in Detroit in a way that it's not in many other places. Jazz is still deeply embedded within the African-American community here. There still is a large segment of the African-American community that comes out to Detroit, comes out to clubs, that goes here, that goes and hears the music. And when you go hear music in Detroit with a Detroit audience, you're sitting there with people who maybe went to school with Tommy Flanagan or Jerry Allen or Bob Hirst or are from their families. I mean, I can, you know, I've met family of Roland Hanna, Milt Jackson, Tommy Flanagan, Barry, and others at gigs, you know, just around town. I gave a book talk at the Detroit Public Library a few months ago, and Kenny Burrell's daughter was there. So you feel that legacy, but you feel it among the audience because the audience here is so informed about the music and it matters to them on a deeply cultural level. I'll tell you a story. The Detroit Jazz Festival, and so for your international people, what I would suggest is if they really want to get a taste of Detroit's jazz scene, what they should do is come Labor Day weekend. We host the largest free jazz festival in the world.
Wow.
Held in downtown Detroit, multiple stages, music going continuously, and you'll hear national, international stars, but you'll also get a real taste of who the local musicians are here in Detroit, and you can hear them in this setting. And the festival every year is very, very sophisticated about celebrating Detroit's jazz legacy. So you can really hear the past, present, and future of the music here in Detroit if you come to the festival. And the festival, so it's a free festival, so you see this, the entire swath of, you know, of Detroit, and socioeconomically you get everything here at the festival. And the audiences are so knowledgeable and so respectful. This last fall or last summer at the festival, Ron Carter and Pat Metheny played duets.
Wow.
And they played on an outdoor stage. I mean, it's outdoors on a big stage. There was probably 8,000-10,000 people crowded around this outdoor amphitheater. And Ron and Pat are playing duets. They're playing a ballad at 4 in the afternoon. You could hear a pin drop.
Wow.
And that does not happen, you know, in other places, but it happens in Detroit. And the musicians will tell you that Detroit has the best audiences because they, again, they're so connected to the tradition. And it's been that way, you know, for much of the century. And, you know, the audiences, this is something that doesn't get talked about a lot, but the audiences are a huge part of, you know, creating a jazz scene. If you don't have audiences, then you're not going to have musicians playing in clubs, and you're not going to have this feedback loop that happens between musicians and audiences and the musicians, you know, creating this kind of synergy together. I talk about this in my book. You know, in the 1950s, Joe Henderson told me, you know, that the Detroit audiences were like musicians, that everybody knew, and there was no way you could get up on that bandstand jiving, said, you know, because they knew the difference. And yet we had such high standards here and such knowledgeable audiences, but they were also very nurturing. So it's not like when you go hear jazz in New York sometimes, you can see there's the musicians playing, and then you can see the musicians sometimes lined up at the bar and other sort of people sort of maybe a little jaded with their arms crossed saying, you know, let's hear what you got.
Yeah.
It's not what I would call a nurturing sort of environment.
Yeah.
In Detroit, Elvin Jones would talk about in the audiences in the 1950s saying, you know, it was like a whole community was behind you and was helping to participate in the creation mm-hmm. of this art form. And he had never seen anything like that before or seen anything like that since. And so you still feel that kind of relationship with the music among the audiences when you come to hear jazz here in Detroit. And, you know, in my book, Regina Carter says at one point, she says, you know, the community raised us mm-hmm. here. And what she meant by that, she meant two things, I think. She meant, one, the mentors like Marcus Belgrave, and there were others of Marcus's generation, the late pianist Ken Cox, the late saxophonist Donald Walden, the late pianist Harold McKinney. All these people were important mentors, with Marcus maybe first among equals. That's when she says the community raised us, she meant that. But she also means that the community, as in the broader audience mm-hmm. for jazz in the city and music lovers and the way music is revered here in Detroit, that community raised us. You know, this stuff, you know, we started this conversation by saying that what happened in Detroit was not an accident.
Right.
And that's still true. The music thrives here. It struggles the way it struggles everywhere. There are too many musicians, not enough clubs. I mean, you could say that about every city in the
yep.
country, right?
Yep.
And, you know, but still there's a spirit and a soul and a creative spark about the music here that comes from a particular set of circumstances and people and a history here. And you feel that when you go hear jazz at a club here or when you're at the jazz festival.
Well, you know, as a musician that an audience can somehow magically pull music out of a band. You know, I don't know if I'm just,
yeah.
You know, you
no,
can't. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you feel when you're on stage, you can tell when an audience is with you
mm-hmm.
and is on your side or not on your side.
Yeah.
You know, Detroit audiences are vocal, as jazz audiences can sometimes be, you know, and they'll let you know. You know, Terrence Blanchard tells a great story about when he first came to Detroit to play with Art Blakey, and he was walking to the stage at this club, and a man in the audience looked at him and said, kind of pointing his finger, says, "I'll be listening to what you're playing." And that, you know, sort of just a representation of that our audience here really gets it. So
are there any particular, if someone comes other than Labor Day, and it sounds to me like Labor Day weekend is absolutely the time to come. And if you're listening to this in Japan or in France or Switzerland, and you want to have a deep jazz experience, it sounds to me, based on how Mark is describing this, that this is a festival that you really want to see. But if someone's not there at Labor Day, are there particular venues or even sometimes particular schools? Like, for instance, in Boston, people can go to Berklee and New England Conservatory and often catch amazing jazz performances. There's what kind of places would you recommend people check out in Detroit?
Well, there are three, at the moment, there are three sort of full-time jazz clubs. One is called Cliff Bells, right in the heart of downtown Detroit. You know, jazz 6-7 nights a week, mostly local, which is to say, you know, Detroit-based talent, but they do bring in some national acts on occasion. Then there's over on the east side, there's the Dirty Dog Jazz Cafe, which is a fine restaurant as well as but it's really a listening room. I mean, they shush the audience. It's music is the focal point. That place is owned by a woman named Gretchen Vallade. And Gretchen Vallade is an heir to the Carhartt clothing fortune.
Oh.
And she is the owner of Mack Avenue Records, which most of our listeners will recognize as an important jazz label that's based here in Detroit, that, you know, for whom Christian McBride and Kenny Garrett and, you know, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and many others, you know, record for Mack Avenue Records. Gretchen, who owns that label, is also the primary benefactor behind the Detroit Jazz Festival Foundation.
Okay.
And she owns this, you know, 5-night-a-week, 6-night-a-week jazz club, the Dirty Dog Jazz Cafe over in Grosse Pointe on the east side of Detroit. And they book by the week which is nice. So it's the same band Wednesday, Wednesday through Saturday. Again, top local bands, as well as they'll bring in national talent too. And then Baker's Keyboard Lounge, which is at 8 Mile Road in Livernois, right on the northern border of the city. And Baker's Keyboard Lounge is a historic club that's been in the same location since 1933. It basically runs neck and neck with the Village Vanguard as the oldest jazz club in the country.
Oh.
Most people, this is complicated. It depends on when did they start having music, what counts as jazz, what's continually operated mean, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly Baker's has a legitimate claim to the title of oldest jazz club in America. And, you know, it's a cozy little bar with small room that has great acoustics, cozy banquettes. Basically looked the same since a remodel in 1957. There's a curved keyboard bar, a literal, you know, with the imprints of a, like a piano keys on it. And, you know, it's been, it was through the from the late 1950s into the 1980s, it was six night a week, you know, seven night a week club. This is where Oscar Peterson and Brubeck and Gillespie and, you know, Stan Getz and all those, Horace Silver, all those folks would play. And in more recent decades, it's focused on local talent, but it's, there's good soul food there and jazz. And so those three places, you know, are places I would think about. And then, you know, there are lots of other nonprofits that, the Detroit Symphony has a major jazz series. They also have a smaller recital hall called The Cube, where they present jazz as part of the mix there. And that's on the radar screen. There are clubs in Ann Arbor, which is 45 to 50 minutes away, which in Detroit is not a bad drive, that we think of all of that as part of our local scene. And there's a fabulous new club there called the Blue Llama that's bringing in national names plus featuring local talent. You know, you come here, you pick up the free weeklies, you look for jazz calendars, WEMU-FM, out of Ypsilanti, Michigan, which is part of our area, has a jazz calendar. The Southeast Michigan Jazz Association, SEMJA, S-E-M-J-A, online probably has a deep jazz calendar that will put you in touch with where people are playing and the like. So those are things that I would recommend.
Great. Thank you so much. Wow. And, you know, just to start wrapping this up, you know, Mark and I, all we've talked about is Detroit jazz. We haven't mentioned Motown, which also echoed throughout the world. We haven't mentioned the Detroit blues scene, which was, and I think probably still has some significance to it. We haven't mentioned techno, which originated in Detroit. So this city is a major and sort of an Athens of musical culture in the world. And I think if you've been to New York and you want to try something different, or you want to bypass New York and go to a city that's got deep, deep, deep American music roots, you can't go wrong with Detroit, and you can't go wrong with jazz from Detroit. Mark, thank you so much for writing this important book and documenting this very important story. It's amazing how someone can be a jazz fan for a long time and not realize that jazz didn't grow up in New York City. And that a lot of the great players came from somewhere else, and that somewhere else was the great culture of Detroit.
Yeah, you know, just to piggyback on a couple of things you just mentioned, I do think it's important to recognize that Detroit has been a major contributor to all kinds of American vernacular music, as well as classical music. And so, you know, when you think John Lee Hooker,
yeah,
right, is from here, and you think of all the Motown people, plus Aretha Franklin, and then you think about Detroit rock and somebody like a Bob Seger or proto-punk bands like the MC5 and Iggy, you know, and Iggy Pop from here, and that Patti Smith lives here for, you know, through the 1980s and 90s, and that techno, the Belleville Three, Juan Atkins and Derek May, and that group of people that created techno music, and then Carl Craig, all that comes from here. Really important experimental classical composers like Robert Ashley and Roger Reynolds are from Detroit. Important classical musicians like the violist Kim Kaskashian and the violinist Ida Kavafian and her sister Annie Kavafian and Ruth Laredo, the pianist. And then you think about the major conductors of the Detroit Symphony going back to the early part of the 20th century and the Russian pianist named Osip Gavrilovich, and then through mid-century with Paul Paré, and then later Neeme Järvi and Antal Durati, and more recently Leonard Slatkin as music directors at the Detroit Symphony. You know, it's an incredibly rich legacy. So if people come here to visit, you can get a kind of a taste of all that. I mean, if you come, do not miss going to the Motown Museum here, which, you know, it's small. So I encourage people to like make a reservation to make sure that you can get in, but to get a tour of the Motown Museum and to be down there in Studio A in the Snake Pit, and to be where all of that music was recorded, is a really moving experience. And so, yeah, music here, you know, starting from mid-century, it just, particularly in African-American communities, music just seeped out of the windows and under doors and out of clubs and just coated the city in this haze of blues and swing and African-American culture. And it's still here.
Beautiful, beautiful. And the jazz part of the story is in Jazz from Detroit. And I know we have a lot of serious readers out there. This is definitely a book to get. You really can't understand jazz without knowing the Detroit story. Mark Stryker, thank you so much for your time. And again, thank you for writing this beautiful book. And I know how hard it is to put a book together. It's always a labor of love. And you really did a beautiful job with this.
Thank you so much for spending this time with me and focusing a spotlight on, you know, something that is just, it's so important, not just to me, but to our city. Detroiters are very, very proud of what they've created. This is a city that, you know, has been through a lot, and a lot of people take a lot of shots at Detroit. Some of our wounds here are self-inflicted, but we have, you know, in the end of my book, Rodney Whitaker, the bass player, says, look, we do two things in Detroit. We make cars and we make jazz musicians. And it's really important to us, and I think to American culture, to remember how important Detroit has been in the trajectory of the 20th and 21st centuries. And it's not just automobiles. It's also art and culture and music. And in particular, it's jazz.
Well, you know the tree by its fruit. And we have, you know, we have over 30,000 email subscribers to Jazz on the Tube. Not all of them listen to the podcast, but a good chunk does. And I like to think that they're advocates and ambassadors for jazz in, you know, at large, and also for specific causes. And so I hope everybody listen to this, share this one with your friends, talk up Detroit. Let people know what an important, you know, we're such a rich country. We have so much culture and so much genius. It's easy to overlook a particular hotbed of culture, and Detroit really needs to be right at the, you know, when you're talking about jazz, you know, New York, of course, New Orleans, of course, you got to talk about Detroit too. So again, Mark, thanks a lot. The book again, Jazz from Detroit.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. We'll be right back.